All right, we're doing the Rambam Hilchot Chametz Umatzah, Perek Zayin, Chapter 7. He talks about the mitzvos that pertain to the observance of Pesach, specifically to the Seder. The Seder is very, very important. It's a very unique type of a mitzvah. It's very unusual. It's very different. And now that you've mentioned it, just before we begin, we find something in Pesach. There's tremendous stringencies that pertain to chametz. In that, the Torah goes further in the restrictions on this forbidden food of chametz than on ordinary forbidden food. As we've seen, there's no prohibition against owning treif products or even having them in your house. But chametz on Pesach, we are commanded to remove it, to destroy it, to remove it from our possessions. And hence, one is not permitted to possess chametz on Pesach. Additionally, with regard to chametz on Pesach, there's no concept of bittul. The halacha is that chametz is oser b'mashehu, which is contrary to other forbidden foods, and that if forbidden food falls in together, is mixed together with kosher food, so it's batel b'shishim. It becomes nullified. That's not the case with chametz. If chametz should become, any admixture of chametz is prohibited. So, we do see that chametz has the characteristics of a prohibited food, and in many senses, as I've just shown, it's more stringent, it's stricter. Now, I think we can learn something from this. There is a theory which maintains that the reason why the foods that are prohibited is because there's something in the food itself which is bad for you. There is even a theory that, or it used to be, that from a physical standpoint, these foods are unhealthy. And we rejected that theory. We said that the purpose of the Torah is not to be a guide in terms of physical health. It's a generalized mitzvah that a person has to take care of his health. But the specifics are up to mankind. There's also a theory that it has some kind of a negative effect on you spiritually. It sort of dulls you in a spiritual sense. That's the type of language that they utilize. All right, let me quote to you from the Art Scroll Chumash. This is found on page 597 of the Art Scroll Chumash, which has a pretty good commentary, summarization. It brings down different commentators on different aspects of the Chumash. Now, in chapter 11, the title, The Laws of Kashrus. At the end of this chapter, the Torah stresses the reason for Kashrus in very clear and powerful terms. By observing these laws, the Jew can pull himself up the ladder of holiness. By ignoring them, he not only contaminates himself, he gradually builds a barrier that blocks out his comprehension of holiness. Just as someone who is constantly exposed to loud music and harsh noise, slowly and imperceptibly, but surely, suffers a loss of his ability to hear fine sounds and detect subtle modulations. So too, the Torah informs us, a Jew's consumption of non-kosher food deadens his spiritual capacities and denies him the full opportunity to become holy. And worst of all, it renders him incapable of even perceiving his loss. For this reason, Ramah cautions that even small children should be prevented from eating forbidden foods, lest their spiritual potential be harmed. See, in the Jewish world, people have coined certain terms, and even though they've never explained what they mean or how they've arrived at them, but everybody sort of takes them for granted, even though they don't know what it means. It just has a certain emotional meaning to them. You talk about kedusha, about holiness, and about impurity. This, it doesn't necessarily mean according to this view, it seems to be that there's something inherently a problem with these foods. These foods are inherently destructive to you. It's like loud music. It dulls you. It has a effect on your spiritual potential. That's what they're saying. What exactly spiritual potential is, and how does the eating of certain foods affect it? They don't deal with that. They just assume everybody takes that for granted. You're positing laws. You're positing cause and effect on entities that you yourself have. You're creating these categories. You're not explaining what they are in a manner that we could deal with them, that we know what you're talking about. Would anyone say about two children, one was raised on kosher food, but permitted to do whatever they want. They were raised in a very, they were spoiled. And indulged every whim and so on and so forth. And grew up one way of life, except they were eating kosher food. And another person was raised in a different home where they didn't observe kosher, but was taught respect and discipline and values and appreciation of wisdom and studied Torah and so on and so forth. Who's going to be in a higher spiritual plane? Okay, so you'll say that's true. You'll say that insofar as the kosher is concerned, that may not be there, but all the other things are we have to consider. So therefore, that's not a good test. But let's say two people completely equal in every respect, except one was eating kosher and one was not eating kosher. I don't think you're going to notice any difference. And certainly children, these children we're talking about, are they aware that these foods are prohibited or permitted or whatever? Excuse me. In my opinion, there's nothing intrinsic to this. There's nothing inherently different. There are reasons, of course, why God delineated certain foods as being prohibited. We may not know the reasons for the particular. But the reason for the overall system is what counts. It's part of a system of Kedusha. Forbidden sexual relations is placed around, puts it in the same category as forbidden sexual relations. And forbidden foods, because it's the book of Kedusha, of holiness. It is not easy to find the specific quality of the foods that are prohibited. The rationality of the system inheres in the fact that it's a system which is designed to regulate an individual's life, that the person should not live his life based upon instinctualism, that he should establish within himself a controlling mechanism which is responsible for his instinctual indulgences. The indulgences are not a result of the pressure of the instinct. They're a result of the functioning of the mind. The mind dictates that which he will consume or what he'll engage in, when he'll engage in it, with whom he'll engage, or what foods he will eat. That's the basic idea. It's part of Kedusha. It's a system of Kedusha, of holiness. If it happened to be that these foods had a negative characteristic and hurt you, well, first of all, why should the Gentiles be eating it? And secondly, why, so then what's the Kedusha? It's not that it's leading to Kedusha. Moreover, as the Ramban explains the concept of Kedoshim Tiyu, the idea of Kedoshim Tiyu, that you should be holy, means that you should not be it's called a Novel Bershus HaTorah. And that's a very significant concept. People violate that concept. That is, a person can be an indulgent person, a hedonist, with the permission of the Torah. That is, you could live a life of hedonism and be very shrewd, be very careful not to violate the halachic requirements with regard to eating, with regard to sexual indulgences. There are ways to get around the laws, but such a person is a corrupt person, even though he's only eating kosher. So it's difficult to maintain that there's any consequence that inherently this food produces a certain type of a dullness of the spiritual capacity of an individual. I find that very, very difficult, that notion. Interestingly enough, there are times when you're permitted to eat forbidden foods. Now, I'm not talking about a case of life and death. That would not be a good example. Because you could say, well, of course, it's better that a person should eat treif than he should die. But there's a better example than that. Under what circumstances is a person permitted to eat kosher food other than danger of life and death. The Rambam in Hilchos Melachim mentions a case where it's permitted to eat so-called treif. Now, everybody knows that it's permitted to eat treif if it's a matter of life and death, for whatever reason, if you're starving or if you have a particular ailment that requires eating of treif food, it's permitted because that's pikuach nefesh. But that wouldn't be a proof one way or the other. However, chalutzei tzava, soldiers, kishayichnasu begvul ha'akam, when they enter into the boundary of the Gentile nations that they're going to be conducting war with, v'yichbashum, and they conquer them, v'yishpu mehem, and they have captives, mutter lehen lechol nevelos utreifos, it's permitted to eat treif, whatever you want, ubsar chazir, pig, uchiyotze bo, im ya'arev, if they're hungry, v'lo motzama yochal, they don't find what to eat. But that's not talking about that they're starving, because they could acquire other foods. And they don't. They found nothing except forbidden foods. Now, if you are Shmuel Lamda, what's the pasuk for this? It says regarding God when you enter into the land, etc. Ubatim aleim kol tov, and you will discover houses filled with kol tov, arpei chazirim, necks of pigs. So that's referred to as tov, kol tov. So the Torah refers to these forbidden foods as tov. They're good. It's very similar to a statement of Chazal. Chazal say that a person should not say, oh yeah, Efshi. I think so, right? I don't have the exact statement. I'm paraphrasing. A person should not say Efshi, Bachilas Chazir, or with arayos, forbidden foods, forbidden sexual relations. Person shouldn't take the attitude of Efshi that I can't do it. It's something I don't really want to do. Like he finds it repulsive. That these things are repulsive. No, Efshi, they're quite doable. I could do it. Efshi umayasa. But what can I do? V'avi shabashamayim gozer alai. But my Father in heaven decreed upon me. That is a very, very significant statement. That is to say, it's not anything which is disgusting about the action itself. To the contrary, the action is very desirable. The entire greatness of the individual is to follow the command of God, to be able to restrict yourself, to refrain from that which God commanded you to refrain from, and to withdraw your energies from it and all the fantasies that are connected to it, and to recognize the fact that it's not essential. It just appears a certain way. It's an illusion. It's not real. There's no reality there. And to live your life in accordance with the truth. That's the training that you get. Now, I wanted to bring a proof that there is nothing inherent in that which is forbidden. From the case of chametz. Now, people, chametz on Pesach creates a certain anxiety in everybody. Jews get very anxious about it, covering everything, and you know, kind of, which is, to a certain extent, it makes sense. Obviously, you have to be very careful because it's a serious prohibition. But I'll ask you the same thing: is chametz on Pesach, does that deaden the heart? Is there anything that inheres in the chametz? It's the same chametz you eat all year long, and it's forbidden food. So you see from that case that the essence of that which is forbidden is not in the quality of the thing itself. This is perfectly good food. Food that you eat all year long. I don't think it changes its character on Pesach. So you see from chametz, that is the quintessential case of something which is prohibited food. It's prohibited because God said to you at this particular point in time to refrain from it. The essence of observing the mitzvot, the essence of avoidance, is to live your life in accordance with the program, with the design of God. It has nothing to do with the particulars. We don't know the reasons why that determined. We don't know that. We don't have access to all the factors as to why God set up these particular. And it wasn't even these particular animals. It was a class. It was this categorization. split hooves and chew the cud. Which again tells you that it's not this particular animal that, but it's because it has certain signs. Another case, it's interesting. The most stringent rules pertain to the prohibited foods that are otherwise permitted. Among what is the most serious, the most stringent among the prohibited foods? Not chametz. Chametz is very serious, but chametz is only on Pesach. All year long, it's meat and milk. Now there too, is there anything meat and milk? That's a perfect thing. That's the worst kind of treif. A cheeseburger is the worst kind of treif. So what are you going to say? That there's something inherently in the makeup of the cheeseburger that causes this contamination of the heart? It's made from kosher meat, which you can eat. Kosher cheese you can eat. And according to the Torah, you could even eat them together. According to the Torah, you all just can't cook them together. All right, midrabanan, we make a fence around the Lord. We don't eat them together. We even wait between meat and milk. Fine. But according to the Torah concept, you could have meat and milk together. It's just that you can't cook them together. Bishul. And even there, according to the Torah concept, it would have to be what the Torah recognizes as bishul, meaning al yedei ha'esh. But if it was from the sun, the heat of the sun cooked it, it would be permitted. So you can't tell me that there's something magical, there's something taboo-like or mystical that inheres in the physical makeup of the food that has a bad spiritual effect on you. It's the observance of a system.
Yeah.
The problem with Judaism, the difficulty, I don't mean the problem, it's not a problem, but when I say problem, I mean how people perceive it, is that people are looking for the magical solution. Many people observe the letter of the law of Kashrut, but they don't achieve the true purpose of moderation, of discipline, of not overeating. To the contrary, many Orthodox religious Jews, on one level or another, abuse food, or they're obese, or whatever it is, eating tremendous amount of involvement in eating, but extremely careful that it be absolutely kosher. The difficulty in Judaism is that it doesn't provide that magical pill that everybody is looking for. And that's why the other religions are more popular, because they offer you the magical pill. Christianity, you want eternal life? That's what you got to have. They tell you got to have Jesus. That's it. You got it. Boom, boom, boom. Doesn't matter what you do. After all said and done, you could be the worst gangster. If you got the water, the holy water, the sacrament, whatever it is, boom, you're in heaven. Heaven, hell. That's what people want. They want to be bothered. And Judaism doesn't offer anything like that. You've got to attain a certain degree of perfection through the mitzvos. The idea that you have to attain a certain perfection through the mitzvos, which requires understanding it and implementing it into your life, that it's really about how you live your life, is something which is very troubling to most religious Jews. Because they just want that safety net. They want that ticket to heaven. Okay, now we're getting in the Rambam in Perek Shavi. Mitzvah asei shel Torah. This is important. It's a mitzvah asei shel Torah. It's a positive command. L'saper b'nisim v'niflos. Shenasu lavosenu b'mitzrayim. To discuss, to tell of the wonders and miracles that occurred to our fathers in Egypt, B'leil Chamisha Asa, B'Nisan, on the night of the 15th of Nisan. Shenemar, as it says, Zachor es hayom hazeh, Asher yitzasam Mitzrayim. Remember this night that you left Egypt. K'mo Shenemar, as it says, Zachor es hayom hashavas. Now, what is interesting in the Rambam's formulation? But for those who haven't heard it, what I find interesting in the formulation of the Rambam is, what is the essential thing? Is it the essential thing to tell about the story of the Exodus, or is the essential thing to tell about the miracles that attended the Exodus? What would you say from his formulation? It seems that the emphasis is on the miracles, to discuss the miracles. Now you'll say, but one second, obviously you have to, if you're going to discuss the story and the story contains miracles, so then of course you're going to discuss the miracles. So why am I making an issue out of this? The reason I'm making an issue out of this is because if that's the case, you should have simply said that the mitzvah is to discuss the story of the Exodus. And once you're talking about the Exodus, so you'll mention the miracles. But he didn't say that. apparently the highlight, the focus has to be the discussion of the miracles that attended the Exodus. So you are telling the story of the Exodus. But the miracles are not just some detail in the background, but they assume the prominent place in the retelling. What you got to retell is really the miracles. And the question, of course, is why? Why are the miracles so important? Now, let's proceed for a moment. Go to Halacha Beis. Halacha Beis, we learn about a new dimension of the mitzvah. Halacha Beis. We just did Halacha Aleph. Halacha Beis, mitzvah lo'di l'banim. It's a mitzvah to inform the children. The afilo lo shalu. And even if they didn't ask. As it says, v'garta levincha, you shall tell it to your children. Now the question we have to ask is that a different mitzvah? And we now have two mitzvahs. One mitzvah is to tell the story, to discuss the miracles. That's mitzvah number one. And mitzvah number two is to teach the children. Are they two separate mitzvahs, or are they really one mitzvah? Now the Rambam says, l'fi daito shel bein av malamdo, that the father teaches him in accordance with his das, with his level. That's an idea which is expressed in the Haggadah, Keneged Arba Banim, that there are four different sons, which are not just differentiated along intellectual lines, but also in terms of attitude, emotions, their whole disposition must be taken into consideration if you're going to educate. Ketzad. Now the Rambam provides something which is very important, because I'm sure as parents of children and small children, you want to know how old or how developed does the child have to be in order to... This is a chiyuv. If you have a child, you got to teach the child. At what point in time does the child become eligible for this kind of teaching? So he says, Ketzad, imhoya katan otipesh. If the child was a katan, was just young, immature, or silly. Tipesh is someone who's silly. Omer lo, he says to him, Bini, my son, kulanu hayinu avadim. All of us were slaves. Kamo shifchazu. Just like this shifcha, this servant. The shifcha is the term for a female servant. Oh, kamo evetzeh. Or like this male servant. The Rambam is assuming you have in your house. I guess in those days they had servants. So you point to the servant. Everybody recognized the difference between the servant and the regular person. Today we don't really have servants. I don't know if today's, if you have a maid or a live-in, I don't know if that really is the same. I don't know that children relate to a live-in as being a servant, and that's as little, someone who doesn't have freedom is not a free person. But as I said, I don't think it's vital to have an actual servant. I said you could use books with pictures in it. As long as the child can relate to the concept of a slave, you could have other devices to illustrate. The Rambam, in my opinion, is just saying that it should be illustrated. You should illustrate the point to the child. B'Mitzrayim, we were all slaves. All of us were slaves. Who is all of us? Who? Is all of us a reference to the family or to some larger entity? This is an important question, because we're trying to figure out what are the concepts that a child would have to be able to relate to in order for us to be obligated to do the mitzvah of teaching the child. Who is the kulanu here? Is it the nation? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if the Rambam means by kulanu all of us. I would tend to think all of us. All of us can also mean not just us, but the Jewish people. So that would mean that the child would have to be cognizant that there is such a thing as the Jewish people. There's a larger unit that we all belong to, which is not that difficult. I think children are aware of that, that we're not the only Jews in the world. They may not know the full parameters of what the Jewish people are and who it includes, but they know that there's different kinds of people, different groups. There's Jews, there's non-Jews. Children pick up on that. Well, here the Rambam is establishing. If the child cannot relate to this idea of slavery and freedom, so he's exempt. He's not ready yet for the mitzvah. He's got to be able to relate to that. Ubalayla hazeh, on this night, Pada osanu HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God redeemed us, Vayetzeinu l'cheirus, and took us out to freedom. Then he says, now what's strange over here is that in formulating the mitzvah now, the Rambam doesn't mention about telling him about the miracles. and wonders. Which he started out by saying that that's fundamental. Here he does not mention that. And if the Ben was a Gadol and a Chacham, was a wise son, Modio Mashi'ir Alonim B'Mitzrayim, we inform him what took place in Egypt, V'nisim Shenasu Lanu, and the miracles that were done for us, Ayide Moshe Rabbeinu, via Moshe Rabbeinu, Hakol Lefi Daito Shel Ben, everything according to the level of the son. So, okay, that idea of telling the miracles, that comes up when you have the child who's advanced. But for the younger child, he doesn't require that. The simplest level is where you just tell him we were all slaves and we became free. So the question is, we have two questions. Actually, we have three questions. Is first of all, what does the Rambam mean with his emphasis on the miracles when he discusses the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim at the beginning of Halacha Aleph? Two, what is the mitzvah of Vigadita? Is that an additional mitzvah? Or is there just one mitzvah? How many mitzvahs do we have with regard to this? And third, when it comes to teaching the child, the minimal level does not include the capacity to discuss miracles. It's merely slavery and freedom. But why? If miracles is the essence of the story, so then why is it that we don't wait? Why don't we wait until he gets older to be obligated to teach him the story? With regard to the issue of the miracles, we'll take up the importance of the miracles. I want to quote to you from the Ramban. The Ramban on the first pasuk, Anochi Yad Hashem Elokecha, Asher Hoteseicha Me'aretz Mitzrayim Mibeis Avodim. And the pasuk ends, Lo Siya Lecha Elohim Acher Malponai. Which says that that's a mitzvah saseh. It's not just saying, I am the Lord your God, but that is true, but that's the mitzvah to believe, to affirm, acknowledge that the God is our God. But what does that mean? Now, many people have noticed that when God is, so to speak, identifying who he is, how we should know him, refers to the one who took you out of Egypt. I'm the one who took you out of Egypt. That's how he addresses. But the question is, why doesn't it say, I am the Lord your God who created heaven and earth? That should be the real basis for our obedience to God, for acknowledging God, has to do with that God's the creator. That's certainly more prominent or more primary. So the question is, why is the Torah here identifying God in terms of Mitzrayim? So he says that Anochi Hashem Yorev Vitzaveh Osam, God instructs them and commands them. Interesting expression, sheyedu v'yaminu, they should know and believe. He doesn't just say that they should believe, but they should know and believe.
Why does he just say should know?
Now, the objective over here is the emunah, the belief, that it's something that we believe in. The Rambam in the Mora explains that believing in something means that you ascertain its reality, that it corresponds to reality, that it's true. So you have to relate to this notion in terms of a belief. It's something that you really believe in. It's different. That's different than saying just you know something. A lot of things you know, but they're not that significant. They don't become a belief. A belief is something which is fundamental to you, which is significant to you. But it's yedu v'yaminu, that the belief that you have is not just the result of some emotion that you have, faith. Hold it a second. The Ramban is saying, Yedu v'yaminu, that the emunah should be rooted in your mind, in your study, in your knowledge, in your understanding. Ki yesh Hashem, that there is a God, v'hu Elokim lahem, and he's a God to you. Now, what the Ramban is leading us to is that Judaism does not just demand that we affirm that there's a superior being or that there's a supreme being. Many philosophers had the notion of a supreme being. Aristotle, for example, believed in God. And so did Einstein. Many of the great scientists believed that the world is filled with absolute wisdom and order and planning. It has to be related to some supreme being, that there is a God. But they didn't agree with us. They did not agree with Judaism, for example, on the issue of providence, of miracles, that this being is actively involved in governing the world, and that man has to serve, so to speak, serve. We have to understand what that means, but man has to worship God, and there's consequences, reward and punishment, all these different types of things, which are the essential aspects of what people would call religion. He says we have to believe that there's a God, that he exists, and that he is kadmon, that he is eternal. Me'ito hoya hakol, that everything comes from him. V'chefetz v'cholas, with will and power. V'hu Elokim lohem, and he's a God to them. Shechayavim lavod oso. That's what we were created for, and we can't escape this. That's our mission in life, is to serve him. Our concept of God, the way the Rambam explains it in Yesodei HaTorah, the type of belief we have to have in terms of God and in terms of the creation, the rest of creation, is that nothing has any capacity of existing by itself. The only true existence is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is God. God alone exists. Hu Elokeinu Eino. There's nothing else besides God. And everything else in the so-called realm of the created owes its existence to God, even though we can't fathom why God created us. We can't give any reason as to why God created us, merely that his wisdom, his will dictated that we should exist, which we can't comprehend. But that everything that exists, exists only because God willed it into existence. And once it's created, it has no basis for existence except the continuous will of God. It exists only as long as the will of God relates to it. If the will of God should cease to relate to it, then it would cease to exist. As the Rambam says, that if we could imagine that everything in the world would cease to exist, see, he, blessed be he, would exist because he's not affected by the existence of his creations in any way. He's not dependent upon them. He did not create them because he needs them or anything along those lines. We provide no service whatsoever to the Creator. So why did God create us? See, that question is rooted in human activity. Man, whatever we do for a reason, for a purpose, because it's rooted in a certain need that we have. And the object serves a purpose for us. That's not the case with regard to the Creator. But he says, if we could imagine that he did not exist, if you could imagine such a thing, then nothing else could exist. There'd be nothing else in existence, because everything owes its existence to the existence of God and his will. Now, early philosophers, or even later philosophers, I believe, maintained that there's a God, as Aristotle did, but they had a different conception of the relationship between God and the world. They maintained that the world is eternal, co-eternal with God. And that the world does stem from God, owes its existence to God, but not in the way we understand it, that it's a result of God willing it to exist, but it's a necessary phenomenon. It's a necessary result of the existence of God, the nature of God, so to speak, demands that the world should exist. The philosophers, like Aristotle, denied divine providence. They denied consequences. They denied miracles. That is, they denied the whole idea of God ruling over the universe. Of course, he was a rational philosopher and advocated that man should lead an ethical life. That's for the perfection of man. But that it should have any kind of a consequences in terms of the Creator ruling over his creation, that he denied. And you could understand that. According to that system, there's no room for miracles. Miracles are an impossibility. Because if the world is the way it is because of the nature of God, it's rooted in the very existence of God, so then just like God is unchangeable, everything that stems from God is unchangeable. That is to say, the world is the way it is because it has to be that way. It's intrinsic that it has to be that way, and then that's the way it is eternally. Can't change. That's the theory of the eternity of the universe. That's why the miracles of Egypt were necessary, Sarah. The miracles of Egypt were necessary to not just to affirm the existence of the Creator, but even more significant, the relationship between the Creator and the universe. That the Creator is apart from the universe, and that God brought everything into existence as a result of His will. And He set it up in a certain way, and He retains absolute control over it. He can terminate its existence, and the laws of nature are there because that's the way God willed it to be. It could be a different way. God can make changes in the laws of nature. That is the testimony of Egypt. In the phenomena of Yetzias Mitzrayim, in the story of the enslavement and the exodus of the Jews, that was the purpose of these miracles. It was not only to effectuate the release of the Jews. The release of the Jews could have been effectuated in many, many ways. That shows you the divine providence. All the different aspects of divine providence are to be found in this story. That God created the world, designated man's existence for a purpose. God's relationship to the Jewish people. God's providential mastery over the universe. And significantly, the idea of miracles. Miracles which override the system that God Himself established. And it says, Asher Hotzei Sichem Eretz Yisrael, Ki Hotza Osa Misham, the removal from there, Torah teaches us about the existence and the will. Because with knowledge and with providence, from Him did we leave Egypt. It also teaches about Chiddush. Chiddush means creation. Ki im kadmos ha'olam, because with the eternity of the world, lo yishtane dav mitivo. Nothing can change from its nature. Its nature is a predetermined, it's a foregone conclusion. The Torah al ha'yecholas, and it teaches us about God's power, and the power leads us to the idea of Yichud Hashem, and so on and so forth. We're not going into every different aspect of it. But a fundamental aspect of the story, there's aspects of the story, obviously. We have to tell the story because this is the foundation of the entire system of Yahadus. And the recognition that we're a distinct people and that God related to us and charged us with a mission, and so on and so forth. But in terms of the miracles, it has to do with establishing fundamentals. That's, well, of course, it's contained in the idea. This is the idea, Asher, that God created heaven and earth. I am the Lord your God who created heaven and earth. It doesn't say that. But it's leading us to that idea, because that's not something we've experienced. We haven't experienced creation. That's the whole question. The whole question is whether the world is a result of creation or not. And the events of Mitzrayim confirm creation. From there, we could see that there was creation, and it's fundamental in giving us our entire concept of God. The fundamentals, the foundation. That's why this is the night of establishing the whole foundations of our religion. To explore, to examine, to establish the foundations, and to study the foundations of our religion. That's why the story per se, that is from this purely subjective standpoint, from us. Today most people have wanted to know what happened to us. We were oppressed, we were slave, God intervened for us. That's part of it. That's part of it for us because we have a special role to play. But the demonstration of the miracles in and of themselves, the greatness of the miracles, that's a very important thing. That's why you see that God takes that up at length. How many miracles there were, how many changes, how do we know that each one that took place was really five miracles? That entire discussion about the nature of the miracle, and that could also be related to the categorization, Datzach, Hadash, B'yachav, to categorize them and so on and so forth. There's a separate idea of exploration of the significance of the miracles that took place in Egypt, because they are fundamental to establishing the correct idea of God as the creator and the negation of the eternity of the universe. The fundamental purpose and objective of the blatant miracles attending the Exodus was to demonstrate Shinui HaTeva, change of nature, that nature is not an absolute, that nature is subject to change. Why? Because everything exists because of creation. The idea of creation was established.